Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello there and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour, bringing you a special feature focusing on the late Pope John Paul II's personal reflections regarding the fall of communism, taking an in-depth look at the Basilica of San Bartolomeo, neatly tucked away in a corner of Rome's Tiber Island, and shining the spotlight on a pope who owned his own tobacco factory. But first of all, join me for some of the latest news from the Vatican. In particular, in a few moments, I'll be mentioning a couple of books. The first is connected to what's been referred to by some as the Sistine Chapel of Calligraphy, an illustrated copy of St. John's Bible bound in 7 volumes, which was given to Pope Benedict XVI on Friday by Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, the president of the United States Papal Foundation. Charles Collins tells us about this audience of Pope Benedict's with the Papal Foundation, which didn't just offer the Holy Father the gift of a precious book, but much more. Let's listen.
Pope Benedict XVI met with the Papal Foundation on Friday. The total assistance which the members of the foundation presented to the Pope this year is over $7.5 million, which even surpasses last year's contribution. Since 1990, the total gift from the Papal Foundation has exceeded $41 million. The Pope offered his gratitude for the gift.
May our good works continue to multiply, filling our brothers and sisters with the sure hope that Jesus never ceases to pour out his life for us in the sacraments, so that we may provide for the material and spiritual needs of the whole human family.
A founding member of the Papal Foundation, Gerald Raunhorst, tells us more about the foundation's work.
Quite simply, it's anybody who will commit to a major gift. The Vatican does not want us to do broad solicitation. That's for the Peter Pence collection and things like that. And this was founded 20 years ago, and the idea was to get people to be stewards of St. Peter and commit $1 million over time to the foundation. And we now have about 150 members, and we've built up an endowment now of something over $100 million, and more than 5% of that goes to the Pope every year. And he writes back to us of what he wants to give it to, and then we distribute it to those. This year was 100 different organizations all over the world, mostly, though, in the poorer regions of the world.
The Papal Foundation is also involved in building the cultural patrimony of the Church. At the audience, they presented Pope Benedict with the St. John's Bible, the first complete handwritten illuminated version of the Bible created in over half a millennium. I'm Charles Collins.
My thanks there to Charles Collins for bringing us this report. Meanwhile, I'd like to touch on another event which took place here at our radio station, which is connected to a book by the title of A Civilization of Love, this time written by the Supreme Knight of the Order of the Knights of Columbus, Professor Carl Anderson. Lydia O'Kane sat down with him after the meeting and asked him about it.
We have the third anniversary of the passing of John Paul II. You were talking about when he made his address at the UN, he talked about, again, this civilization of love. Do you think that's an echoing part of his legacy?
I think it's one of the most important parts of his legacy. Obviously, historians will look and see all that he did to liberate Europe and really liberate the world from tyranny. And when he spoke at the United Nations in 1995 in that great address which spoke of the family of nations, the conclusion was we should all, regardless of our religion or our race or our geography, come together to work to build a civilization of love, which he said is based on universal principles of justice and freedom and solidarity. So he saw the most universal values at the same time are very Christian values, because where do we see the greatest example of self-giving love? Of course, is in the life and death of Jesus.
Pope Benedict is going to the United States very soon. I was going to ask you about your hopes for the trip in light of what we were talking about, maybe building, continuing to build the civilization of love, reinvigorating faith in the United States. Would they be hopes of yours?
Certainly, very much so. American society is a very religious, faith means a great deal. Trust in God is our national motto. And people regard Pope Benedict as a very important spiritual leader. And so they're waiting to hear what he has to say. Certainly his address to the United Nations will be one of the great addresses of his pontificate. The meeting with the president, President Bush in Washington, will be very important. But also he's speaking to the American bishops. He's speaking to American Catholic educators. He's speaking with leaders of interfaith, different religious faiths, to priests, to youth. So he's, someone was saying this was a short trip and was going to be limited in terms of its events and what the Holy Father would be doing. But already I understand he's going to be giving 17 speeches in 5 days. So he's going to be quite busy.
My thanks there to Leggero Kane for bringing us this interview with the Supreme Knight of the Order of the Knights of Columbus, Professor Carl Anderson. I'll be bringing you a more in-depth version of that interview at the same time on Wednesday. Meanwhile, I'd like to move on in the broadcast and focus on the contents of yet another book, this time one by the late John Paul II, by the title of Memory and Identity, Personal Reflections, published shortly before his death in 2005, in which he bequeaths to us an intellectual and spiritual testament by means of a series of conversations with leading intellectuals, in which he focuses on some of the most challenging issues of his turbulent times. Among the topics he addresses in the publication is his own personal view of the role he himself played in the fall of communism. But get ready to step back in time for a moment to those heady days and watch the change of pace and tone. Do you remember words like perestroika, glasnost, solidarnosc? Words meaning rebuilding, giving voice to freedom, solidarity. Words that take us back in time to the fall of the Soviet era. When the people connected to those words were on the front pages of every newspaper. Perhaps you may remember their names. Mikhail Gorbachev, the last president of the Soviet Union. In Poland, General Jaruzelski, the president of the nation, and Lech Wałęsa, the leader of the Solidarność trade union movement. But also from Poland, Pope John Paul II, whose frontline role has been recognized by many as instrumental in the collapse of that era. But what exactly did he himself say in this regard? Well, let's turn to his book, Memory and Identity, Conversations Between Millenniums, to find out more.
It is ridiculous to think that it was the Pope who really had caused the collapse of communism with his own hands.
Referring there to the book
was Vatican Radio's Cardinal Roberto Tucci, a Jesuit who for many years was chief organizer of Pope John Paul II's pastoral journeys abroad. He explains how, while the Pope from Poland may to some extent deny having held such a clear-cut role in this historical process, not everyone is of the same opinion.
Gorbachev certainly, and also Jaruzelski, stress the role of the Holy Father in the falling down of Soviet Union. But the Holy Father is more prudent I reread yesterday the three passages where I speak about death. And the first one, he says, we know that communism fell down because of the insufficiency of its socio-economic system. In another passage, he admits the great role played by trade union, let us say, Solidarność.
The voice of the leader of Solidarność there.
Because he says that through that movement, not only that brought to collapse the Polish communism, but practically had a great influence in the falling down of communism of the nearby countries, I mean the countries which were around Poland, especially on the eastern side.
Yes, he triggered the process, maybe.
Yeah, he admits a little bit, but not too much. Mm-hmm. He doesn't attribute to himself such a role as other important and many politicians recognize he had really played.
At this point, I thought I'd ask Cardinal Tucci how the Pope's roots and past history had played into the historical process of the time.
I think that the roots of his culture, are very important. He belongs to a country which has been suffering always very much, in its history. He had to fight all the way along to survive between Russia on one side and Germany, Prussia, on the other side. So he was prepared to fight, as I say. In the same book, he says that when he was in Rome studying in the Belgian college, because the Pope prepared a thesis on St. John the Cross when he was in Rome for some years, when he was already a priest before becoming a bishop, a Belgian told him, you Poles were able to resist to communism. If communism would have triumphed in Italy, we would not have been able to resist as we have done. So it's a history behind the Holy Father, the history of the nation, of the Polish nations. We prepared him to that fight. And also the fact that this country has always, for centuries, for a millennium, for more than 1,000 years, he had been always having the same language, the same religion, Catholicism and the Latin Catholicism. With very small minorities. I remember years ago that interviewing Cardinal Wyszyński, who was at the time most important figure of Catholicism in Poland. It was the time of John the 23rd, so many years ago. He was just joking, saying, the very lucky thing in our history is that communism came from Russia. Because if communism would have come from Germany, probably all the intelligentsia of the country would be tempted to become communist. If communism would have been coming from France, perhaps we were all in danger to become communist. But thanks God it came from Russia.
And a big thank you there to Jesuit Cardinal Roberto Tucci for taking us back in time. But I'd now like to look ahead to a place Pope Benedict XVI is scheduled to visit on Monday, 7th of April. That's to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the founding of the Community of Sant'Egidio, a lay movement founded in Rome in the aftermath of the Second Vatican Council and spread since then in 70 nations throughout the world. The venue of this meeting is an ancient basilica which has now become a shrine to the memory of the martyrs of the 20th century, which was entrusted by the late John Paul II to the Sant'Egidio community. It's also the titular church of Cardinal Francis George, Archbishop of Chicago, and it's known as San Bartolomeo, meaning St. Bartholomew. Tucked away in a romantic spot in the heart of Rome, at the edge of an island on the Tiber River, it's linked to the rest of the city by two very ancient bridges. I went there earlier in the week with our Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, to find out more. Slinking in as preparations were underway, and the smell of fresh paint laced the air.
This is a small basilica which has an ancient history, Breda. Yeah. So it's what is the story exactly?
This is a small basilica on top of a smaller church, which takes up about the shape of the presbytery, the raised presbytery you can see now. Let's say the older church was about a third of what we're looking at now, and this is actually quite small. So the early church was the desire of Otto III, the last of the sacred Roman Empire emperors to reign, and he wanted to build a church here in 998 to celebrate Saint Adalberto, who was a bishop martyr of Prague, who died in 997. So what you can see downstairs, which obviously is not open to the public, is a little old chapel. The base is still there. Some of the columns are there. And also the eagle stem of the emperor is still on some of those columns. A Germanic emperor who initiated the Christian space in this particular area. So after that, the church was restored under Pasquale II in 1013. Now, this is the Pasquale who also did a lot of restoration work in San Clemente and Santissime Sante Quattro Coronate because of a lot of damage done there by saccage. But here, actually, lots of problems created by neglect of the area and also overflow of water from the Tiber onto the island and is doing a lot of destruction. So in the 12th century, he had this basic church rebuilt. Obviously, later on, it was embellished and restructured, etc. But the essential shape of what we're looking at now dates back to the 12th century. Now, it's a mini basilica. So you feel the sense of its being mini by those tiny columns that go down on each side, which are from an old temple which was built on this site, in Esculapio, the god of medicine. So it's strange, we're on the Tiber Island, you have a hospital behind us, we have another, the Jewish hospital right next to us, looking straight ahead of here at the altar steps. A very unusual well, which you would never find in any church. There's no church with a well of this type in Rome. They think this came originally, at least the drum of this column, a old Roman column, came from the original temple that was on the spot. Afterwards, obviously, you have these little tabernacles all around with the Christ and two saints and a bishop. So it became a Christian element and became eventually also a baptistry, small baptistry, and also a source of drinking water for people in this area until, of course, the water became contaminated, so it's no longer used for that. Very strange to find this piece in that spot in a church like this. You would never find It's still a well, technically, even though it's full of debris now and it's no longer used. It's about 10 feet deep. But it makes quite a strange impact. I mean, the viewer can sit there and look at this beautiful marvel. The sculpture gives you a soft feeling. You know, it's kind of fluid way into the church. Then you look at the side and you see these ancient temples. Now, in the 1600s, when the church was redone, they put new capitals on top of the original capitals of, obviously, what was a pagan temple. So you have to sort of change the capitals and put these, let's say, false Corinthian temples. So there is another type of capital underneath these, but what you see now is in conformity with most of the chapels or churches that you would see in Rome. So you have the three aisles, which is the classic basilica of Rome. What's very beautiful here is looking towards the main altar, which you can arrive at in about 3 minutes, which is very quick for a church in Rome, because most times you have to walk and walk and walk and then get to the main altar. Here, the opening area to the presbytery is rather beautiful because you have the two columns, which were put in by the cardinal. This became a titular church in 1517, so after which then you had various cardinals who were able to collect money for decoration, etc., etc. Those columns that you can see there just entering into the presbytery area.
Like a triumphal arch.
Triumphal arch, but look at the way the triumphal arch is on the top. It's like an open scroll. It just swirls around and closes in on itself and opens up. And at the top it has a little stem to St. Bartholomew. But then you get the sense of the revelation, because the scroll always has this sense of a message. You just open it and you put it around the triumphal arch and you're giving the message. Now, the great message of this church is martyrdom, because obviously the apostle, St. Bartholomew, who was buried in that magnificent porphyry vessel. I mean, you can't call it a tomb, it's a vessel, but it now is a tomb. This comes from the first or second century, they're not quite sure. And it has a lion and then a little emblem and the name of St. Bartholomew on it, because his relics were moved around quite a lot. For example, they were brought from Benaventura, they were brought here. In certain moments when damage was done to the church, they were taken temporarily to the Vatican. And then again, when the French came to Rome, they were taken temporarily to Santa Maria in Trastevere and then brought back again. So his relics have actually moved around a little bit. So now they're here permanently, and you see this beautiful, imposing altar. I like to see in a church an altar which is imposing. In the past, this altar had a big ciborium with porphyry columns. These columns are now in the Vatican Museum in the Gallery of the Tapestries, so they're kept there. So after that, Pius IX gave them a gift of what they call another altar, like this slab on the top, and fixed the vessel with St. Bartholomew's remains as a permanent altar. So this gives it a certain beauty, and this is the colour of the porphyry, which is this lovely pink and black and pink again, and let's say a little purple in the pink, but it's a very strong colour, and it's reflected, as you can see, in all the colours in the church. There's a kind of joyfulness in the colour, because here underneath each of the columns going down each side, the little archways are painted in darker pink. All around the altar area, the apse, it's a lighter pink with some gold, and the greys are pale greys, and you have lots of nice green, soft green. So the overall effect is a limpid softness. And I think that's what makes the whole area so attractive. I love these Paleo-Christian style churches where you have the raised presbytery. For example, you can see that it has a balustrade. This is not the original balustrade. This was put in the 1600s, because they obviously had to have a balustrade. But in the past, they probably had an iconostasis, a cross, which has gotten lost, so we don't know what happened to it. So the church, because of the amount of times it was flooded, and frescoes also were damaged, lots of different things happened at different times. But it's essentially, it's an important church because we have one apostle here, and an apostle martyr. So we have churches in Rome, apart from St. Peter's, but you have Santi Apostoli, where there are more than one. But the first feeling I had in this church was it was like a Domus Ecclesia, like one of the first Christian spaces that you could have as a house. So if you took away all these seats and you just covered yourself with the atmosphere created by these beautiful columns and the colours, you would feel quite at home. There's a homeliness about the basilica. It's imposing but homely at the same time, and that's kind of complex as a concept. For example, now, at the back there, you have a fresco by a painter from Palermo who shows the martyrdom of St. Bartholomew. And again, there are two little side chapels at the top, each side of the main altar. The overall message here is martyrdom. If you look up near the windows at the top here, you have laurel leaves, you have acanthus leaves, you have palm trees, you have all these elements which relate to the symbols of martyrdom. And it's probably no coincidence that Sant'Egidio has put in here a number of attributes which relate to specific people who were killed in recent times, in what they say in Italian, in odore di santità, let's say, in a saintly way, or the bishops who were killed on the altar who obviously are not yet beatified and whatever. So they keep these, let's say, future relics very liberally in the side chapels. So you have three on each side. But I think the general feeling is, if you walk into, for example, Santa Maria in Trastevere, you have a massive line of columns that take you right into the distance, into something that you have to go and discover. Here you have an immediate embrace because of this triumphal arch, the way it's done with this beautiful curvature of the scroll. So the scroll opens up the message, and the scroll in this particular triumphal arch opens up the message of salvation to us and actually makes us feel very much a part of it.
Heartfelt thanks there to Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, who's currently working at the American University of Rome. And finally, yet another change of tone to end the broadcast as we join our popular Latin lover, who speaks to us today of an argument currently being discussed in the United States in the run-up to Pope Benedict's forthcoming visit there. The subject is an unusual one, the Vatican and tobacco. I say the topic is being discussed because Physicians and Nurses Against Tobacco, a Rhode Island-based organization, is asking Pope Benedict XVI to support its campaign for a tobacco-free society. The group's petition online appeals to the Pope not only to denounce the sale and use of tobacco during his April pastoral visit, but also to declare Vatican City the world's first tobacco-free state. Something the Vatican has never been. Many of the popes themselves have been smokers, as we know. And there's a 19th century pope who once had his very own tobacco factory. I happened to notice this on a plaque on the walls of Rome and asked Carmelite Father Reginald Foster to comment. I was ambling around Rome the other day, precisely in Trastevere, when I couldn't believe my eyes, I saw a plaque on the wall which read, Officina Nicotinorum.
It's Officinam Nicotianis Elaborandis Folies, a solo excitavit. This is Pius IX's tobacco factory. And we have pictures of Pius IX, blessed Pius IX now, with huge, massive cigars in his mouth. He likes cigars. You ever saw those pictures of Pius IX smoking his cigars? Oh, it's a famous thing. But anyway, and
can we
so,
go back to the
and so the fact
inscription?
Is, yes, and it's Officinam. This was a factory. Nicotianis Folies Elaborandis. You go back tonight and you can, that's what it's written there, for processing nicotine leaves.
So this, folias is...
Folia is a leaf.
Folia is a leaf.
And nicotina, of course, the nicotine, tobacco, and then elaborandis, elaborating, or we would say processing. So what did he do? A solo excitavit. He built up from the ground... Officinam is the first word, this factory for processing nicotine leaves. And the fact is, if you go there today, the street next to this building is called Via dei Tabacai, of the tobacco people, and it's Pius IX's tobacco factory.
Heartfelt thanks there, as always, to Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, who currently works at the Vatican's Secretariat of State as the Pope's own Latinist. And that's all I have time for on today's broadcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now, and don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow. Laudetur Jesus Christus.